Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. Welcome back for another week. Listeners, it's good to be with you. This is part two of an undetermined number in this series about Christian nationalism, right? So our guest again today is the Reverend Dr. Shannon Fleck. Welcome back to the program, Shannon.
Thrilled to be back.
Not thrilled that we have to keep talking about this.
Actually, you know, I disagree because I have spent at least 5 years trying to get people to have this conversation. So as often as people want to talk about this, I am thrilled to do so.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good framing then.
There you go.
And so to kind of just set some, parameters or a framework for our conversation today, you and I have already discussed this, but for our listeners' benefit, this conversation, I think we recognize, like, can and should be difficult for a lot of people, right? Like, not, hopefully not like in an offensive way, but I think, and for myself and from conversations I've had with, you know, friends and family, for those of us who grew up in the church in America, particularly in this part of the country, right? In Oklahoma, Texas, the South in general, I think a lot of this stuff to do with this is like baked in to like our, it is fundamental. It is so baked in. It is like fundamental to our understanding of what like the Christian faith is, right? Like there's parts of this that you have to unravel a little bit, and that can be disconcerting. So I just frame that as a bit of a disclaimer that this reminds me of like the first like theology classes that I took in college where our professors were like, listen, we're going to have to break down some things first to build them back up more properly later. And that might be the case for you. Maybe not for all of you. Maybe it feels refreshing. Maybe it feels like a balm on a wound. I don't know. That would be great. But I do think that there's a element of this that is necessarily personal to each of us. And that if we have that conversation in this format, it helps move us closer to the future we all want to live in.
I agree. And I think it's important to that effect to remember that religion and faith are highly intimate facets of people's lives. And we don't ever want to take that lightly. And this is a very intimate conversation.
Yeah. And there's, you know, growth is rarely comfortable.
Right? Oh, yeah, no.
So let's start and kind of back up a little bit to maybe where we left off or towards the end of the last episode. And can you, however you want to define Christian nationalism, but like let's start there with the definition of what we're talking about, because I think those terms are thrown around and everyone kind of like half understands them, but we don't really like fully appreciate what we're talking about.
Right. Christian nationalism is the viewpoint that God and Christianity are intertwined with the founding of our country, and that this is at its very core a Christian nation. And more specifically, Christian nationalism is a political movement that utilizes religious language.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm opening the newspaper here. I have several copies of the Oklahoman on my desk, as you know. And I'm going to quote, I can't believe I'm saying this, but Oklahoma pastor Jackson Lehmeyer.
Okay, let's go.
Who, so this copy of the Oklahoman is from January 14th of 2024, which was a Sunday. And on the front page, right? 1A above the fold, Christian nationalism on like the front, right next to Stint and the Tribes Remain at Odds. Mm-hmm. And so this story is by Carla Hinton from the Oklahoman. And it really, the first half centers on Jackson Lehmeyer. Some of listeners may know he ran for governor, last time. He is, by all accounts, including his own, a Christian and a nationalist. In fact, my quote here is, he's kind of saying like, well, some people oppose Christian nationalism because the media tells them to, which is not always the case. But he says his definition of Christian nationalist is someone who, like himself, who prefers to vote for a fellow Christian who ascribes to the, quote, America first political strategy. Quote, I'm a Christian who is a nationalist, not a globalist. And I will admit, I laughed out loud a little while ago when I was rereading this, where I was like, oh, well, there it is. He says it, both the words together in the same sentence.
Right out of his mouth. There it is.
Yep. And so, Shannon, the way that you broke it down, I think is helpful, right? There are two elements here that are not necessarily always intertwined, but when they are, like a dark magic happens, right? Like sometimes you mix two, you can mix broccoli and chocolate, and maybe it's not the best mix, right? You can mix peanut butter and chocolate, it's way better.
Delightful.
With these two, it's a bit like, you know, mixing, I don't know, I was going to give two incendiary like bomb components, but that's not what this podcast is about. But when you mix a religious ideology and in this case, it happens to be a Christian ideology, right? And a political, as in his words, right? A political strategy. That phrase seems like a very weird thing for a pastor to say.
Right. Doesn't it? And he, when he's quoting that, it's very interesting because when you think about the mentality of America first, that's highly rooted in we are God's chosen country and nobody else matters, which is very anti-biblical.
Yeah. So where do we get the idea that America is a Christian nation? Because I've grown up with that, not assumption, but like that belief was probably just like imparted to me, but I never really thought about it until the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's thought of that way because it's baked into our history. And in version one of this podcast, I referenced the doctrine of discovery, did not go highly in depth on that, but the doctrine discovery is actually a papal bull that came out of the Vatican upon the discovery of the land that is now the United States, along with everything west, like all the way to South America. Right. And it stated, and I quote, any land not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited by Christian rulers, and declared that the Catholic faith and the Christian religion be exalted and be everywhere, increased and spread, that the health of souls be cared for, and that barbarous nations be overthrown and brought to the faith. And that came out in 1493. May 4th, 1493 is the authorship of that papal bull from the Vatican, which then went on to grant permission for European countries to colonize other nations because those other nations weren't Christians like they were, and therefore their land was up for grabs.
Right. And I think, so I think to understand that doctrine of discovery, right? You have to put your mind in the place of a 18th century, I don't know.
15th century.
Or for 15th century, like, yeah, I guess that's true. I'm thinking of like when America was founded, but when, we're not even there yet, right? So a couple hundred years before that, 15th century conquistador or explorer or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the conversation around like Christopher Columbus is a good example of this that I think is starting to be more mainstream, right? Like, it's not just that like a dude got in a boat, came over here and was like, oh my gosh, look at this land. Everything's great. Like, we'll be friends with the natives. No, there was like raping, pillaging, murder, disease. It was not a friendly
No.
encounter.
And they were given permission from the faith to do that.
Right,
Yeah,
right,
according to the
right.
faith, that was permissible.
Yes, it was a deep-seated belief that they were better than
That's right.
any other humans, right? And just, when you think back, and this is like a weird, you think back to writings of the time and like describing indigenous people as savages, and it was like a very we are better than they are kind of thing. And thus, like, we're in the right and we're gonna just take what we want to, but they would just do it under the guise of like, well, God wants us to have it.
That's exactly right. So, quite literally, the idea of this as a Christian nation is intertwined with ideals of colonialism and white supremacy, white European supremacy. So, it was that mindset that was utilized in the conquering of the indigenous people here, the conquering, killing, and or conversion, because it was assimilate or die. Essentially, and then it was also used to justify the slave trade.
Right. Because again, they believed and then reiterated the message to themselves and to the society they were creating that white people were better than everybody else, right? And in some cases, better than certain groups of white people, right? Like it's ironic in some ways that the Doctrine of Discovery came from the Catholic Church when there have been plenty of points in US history where Catholics, especially like the Irish and stuff, were very much marginalized, not necessarily to the same extent as like people from Africa that were enslaved, but that there have been groups that have been on the under the thumb of some sort of, I don't know, I will say ruling class, but like people with resources that wanted to squash others.
Well, and let me just say that that is akin to where the Europeans colonized. So this came as a response to Spain and Christopher Columbus coming over and making that discovery. What ends up happening is the British people occupy what becomes the eastern seaboard of the United States. And where
Right.
were the British at that time? Right? By the time they got over here, they were not Catholic,
Right.
right?
Right. No.
So a lot of that anti-Catholicism that developed in those areas had to do with us being settled by Great Britain
Right.
and not so much Spain.
Right. I had to Google when did the Anglican Church start. That wasn't until later, 1867. That's fine. That's a whole other conversation about.
It is.
Okay, so to kind of back up, Christian nationalism, right, is this merging, enmeshment of Christian beliefs, so some sort of conviction, right? And to be a devout Christian, one must have faith to believe these things fully, right? To accept it as truth. That plus, so like if you have that and then you blend it with messages like we deserve this land, we are better than the people who live there, we are better than the people we brought there, we our leaders are in place because God wanted them to be there, then I guess the part is that starts getting real sticky, right, is that if you were to question some of these nationalist ideas, like these American first ideas, to question those is, would you say it's fair to say like that means you'd be questioning the faith element as well?
Yes, according to Christian nationalism, to ask any questions about this narrative makes you a dissenting non- you're not a real Christian if you're asking things like that.
Right.
Christianity is very much tied up in this America first. Jesus Christ brought the Europeans to this country, and we have got to get back to this place where white Europeans are the people again.
I, you know, I So in the Christian nationalist movement and that set of beliefs, they would point to a bunch of, we'll say, facts that
No.
support. What's that?
I said, oh, sure.
You're right. So one that we hear people point to frequently, right, is that, well, all the presidents have been Christian, which is not necessarily the case, right? Like, and it doesn't explain the whole thing. Like, if you Google it, you look on Wikipedia, it'll kind of go through some people, like Thomas Jefferson, not necessarily a great guy. Was an Abraham Lincoln as well. Like, we're probably deists,
Yes.
which is in there. There's a lot of, but by and large, most identified as Protestant. We've only had two Catholic presidents, right? JFK and Joe
Okay,
Biden.
and Biden.
And even then, different. And then you've got a few, like Nixon was a Quaker, like which I always find odd.
That is.
A few other, like there's several, like Unitarian, but I think even they would identify as being mostly Christian. So how do we reconcile the fact that mostly all of our presidents have at least publicly identified as being Christian, like with this sense that we are or are not a quote Christian nation?
I don't know how we land in a place where we can justify that, except to say that we just haven't gotten there yet. We certainly now are seeing a more diverse Congress at the national level. We do have members of other faith traditions who have been in Congress. They are exponentially in the minority. I remember people panicking that certain candidates were not placing their hand on a Bible to be sworn in, when in reality, that's never been a thing. In fact, the Bill of Rights says there's no religious qualification for political office.
Right.
Yeah, so it's really just indicative of how much further we have to go in order to move forward. And Pew Research Foundation, I spent some time yesterday in some data, and I
I'm looking at it right now,
was
actually.
nerding out on some data. And Pew Research put out some numbers last year. And what you see is what I'm most interested in are the age brackets. And in the age brackets, they're asked questions like, is this a Christian nation? Should the nation be based on Christian values? And it, like, is that, do we want to be a Christian nation? And the younger you go, the less into it they are.
Right.
And that is so at the heart of why we have seen this increase in panic and an increase in the rhetoric, because the upcoming generations are, they're more secular. They're more open. They've had exposure to all sorts of things, and that is a killer to this mindset that we have to get back to this version of America that is not inclusive of every human being.
Right. It's so this, and I'll link to this Pew Research article in the show notes. There'll be a couple of them. So the one that you sent me yesterday, right? This is their most recent one that came
That
out.
is not
Just,
you. That is PRRI, which is
oh, I'm
the,
sorry. Yeah.
Public Religion Research Institute. Absolutely link it, because that is the most recent data to come out, and it just came out last week.
Right. And then I've got an article from Pew from 2022 where they ask some of these questions. And I think a lot of the stuff they ask more frequently, but it strikes me, one, about age, right? The breakdown by age. And then secondly, but even with that, like even with the age brackets, when they ask the question, do you think that the founders of America originally intended for the US to be a Christian nation? Even among the youngest group, 18 to 29, it's like a 50-50 split, right? Like 50% said yes, 49% said no.
Mm.
Which was still like a little bit shocking. It's not as stark as like 73-23 for like the 65 plus, but I some of that, right? Like if you think about the messages you received as a child, right? So you and I are around the same age, so we grew up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. The messages we received from the church in the midst of the Reagan Revolution and the rise of the Christian Coalition and all of this certainly informed our perception of the world and of our government. But even more so for like our parents and grandparents, right? So like our parents are in the, what is now the top age bracket here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, they grew up in the 60s and 70s. And so like a very different message then. And all that compared to like our children who are also about the same age, but like growing up now in the midst of the world we live in, we're depending on where you live, who your parents are, where you go to school, like all those factors. But there's certainly a different perception about the church today than like what our the message our parents received.
Yes. And when you think about the generation that our parents are in, at that point, you know, they were still reeling from the effects of McCarthyism. And there was a lot of Christian nationalists embedded in anti-communist thought.
I was going to say, like, the whole Red Scare, and this is a thing that is mind-boggling to me. When I was reading that book recently, Democracy Awakening by Heather Cox Richardson, and she's, like, telling this story of America, and it's the same story over and over again, that, like, the conversations about socialists and communists in the 1960s with McCarthyism is like verbatim the same rhetoric they're using today. And so when you see people saying, like, complaining about, I don't know, Antifa, or like, oh, the social, like saying Obama is a socialist and this stuff, it's the exact same attacks, like not similar, like the exact same words they used 70 years ago about the same things. And it's like, oh, wow. They didn't like reinvent the wheel. They just used the same wheel.
Well, that wheel also existed in a country called Germany when the Nazi party came to power, and they found themselves a really good enemy. And that enemy, I mean, really good used sarcastically.
Right, right.
But an identifiable enemy that needed to be removed in order to return to this glory. And so it's not a new thing globally, even. The nationalist rhetoric paired with this fear and getting back to this idyllic state, what it really is about is getting power back to those who feel a certain way.
Right. So in this Pew article, there's some quotes from respondents to their survey that I think are hopefully telling, right? Like when they ask people to like describe what a Christian nation means or what, you know, what that looks like. Some people said things like a nation that upholds the teachings of God through Jesus Christ, followers of the principles of Christianity, but they don't often spell out whether like Christianity would hold any kind of official privileged place or just like be it's where we go to for knowledge and wisdom, right? Like, so I think there's like this undercurrent. Let me think how to phrase this. There are clearly people, in fact, it's about a third of America, according to this survey, identify as being Christian nationalist or Christian nationalist sympathizer, right? That's about 30%. And even within that like sympathizer range, like there's some folks who are like, well, it's not officially a Christian nation, but like we all know, right?
Right.
Like, and it's that like
that
subtle assumption mm-hmm. that is like the part that worries me, I think.
Absolutely. And that assumption exists because culture has put those things alongside of each other in really, I'm going to say more safe ways. So in the hall the other day, you and I had a discussion about how a lot of Christian congregations throughout the United States display both the Christian flag and the American flag on their chancel. Right. Or in view of everybody. That has felt, because it's been done for so long, like normal, like right. normalcy. And right. it's a normal experience.
Right. If we were doing this in a live audience, I would ask the audience, raise your hand if you grew up in a church like that. And so listeners, raise your hand in your car or your home, right? Most of us did. And yeah. never even thought. You're just like, oh yeah, right? Yeah. Yep, one's for God, and then, or one's for, you know, the church, and then one's for the country. These are things I believe in.
Yeah. So we've been taught visually that those things go together. Right. We've been taught verbally those things go together in songs we sing, God Bless America. We've been taught that through political rhetoric, even political rhetoric that is more innocuous, like may God bless the United States. But what we're right. seeing then is the evolution of that rhetoric. It has evolved into, as we said the other day in the hall, I declare every county in Oklahoma for Jesus Christ.
Right.
Those are two completely different statements.
Right.
But because we have experienced culture where those things have gone side by side, it almost gives this, it's almost giving validity to this more extreme viewpoint, because they can tie it back to these images and these languages that we've experienced throughout our lives. Right. So it's almost like this subliminal validation for yes. extremism.
That's a really good way to frame that. Subliminal validation, I think, is is exactly what it feels like. And I'll a moment for me to share personally. Hopefully this helps some listeners.
Yeah.
So, you know, I grew up in the church. I went to college to be a minister, and I had a lot of questions that I hadn't really, they were there. I just had never really indulged them or like asked myself. And then I realized if I was going to be in front of a congregation giving answers, right? If I'm the one they're looking to for truth, and I have a lot of doubt about this, I'm probably not the right one to be upfront on that. I was not deeply convicted. And so really started kind of digging in and trying to find answers. And ultimately, I'll just be honest, like that led me down the road that for me, I was like, I think maybe there's something out there, but I'm pretty agnostic. Like, I just don't know if it's knowable. It all for me goes back to the Big Bang. I don't know what happened just before that. I get it. Everything since then is physics, but just before that is a little mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the issue of like the role of spirituality and faith in my life, and I suspect many folks feel this too, that there's, I mean, the data shows, right? Like an increasing number of Americans are like moving away from the church, but still identify as being religious or spiritual. And so often, like in times of crisis, like everyone's got faith in a foxhole, right? Like we're all looking for it. And so you see some like religiosity in times of crisis that can be helpful or like serve as like grounding or some solace. One good example that I personally am deeply connected to is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, right? Which was delivered in the midst of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And he references God at several points. It's a very short speech. And the last line is the one that I think of most often. I'm going to say the last line first. I'm going to come back to something that gets back to what we were talking about. But the last line is, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Okay. But that piece of like, with firmness in the right, as God gives us the right, or gives us to see the right, is like a recognition that, like, I'm trying to do the right thing as much as God tells me what's the right thing. But that obviously leaves open the door for God to tell you something in your mind, but to be bad for youth classes of people. But I don't think that, I don't know, but I don't think that like many people would find Lincoln's level of religious language in this speech to be like Christian nationalist.
Correct. And a big, beautiful piece of that speech is that it is done with clear humility and just an openness. There is humility and openness to be guided to the good and not at all fear-mongering, which is a staple of Christian nationalism, that we're losing our country and we have to get it back. He was saying more like, as God, shows us, but these are our goals. This is, and I'm a limited person trying to lead to this place. And Christian nationalists don't talk like that. There's not a lot of humility or grace or open dialogue when it comes to those viewpoints.
Right. And, just before that line that I read in the speech, he does, like, probably half the speech is pretty faith-based. Obviously, the language is like antiquated and sounds a little clunky now, but like one of the lines is, the Almighty has his own purposes. Then he says, if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom this offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes? So which bubble? Okay, it's getting
So
clunky, but he's basically saying, like, he's saying, okay, well, if God wanted slavery and now he doesn't, but he's given us this war, like, that's a lot of like like pulling yourself out of responsibility for the actions.
But then also you can look at it as he is recognizing this impetus that was present through the doctrine of discovery. Obviously, the language over the hundreds of years affirmed slavery via religion. And now Abraham Lincoln is saying, I don't think so. Like we need to remove divinity from this practice. And so he's essentially, and let me just say that the Catholic Church did not formally renounce the doctrine of discovery until March 30th, 2023. That is less than a year ago.
So just last year, huh?
Just last year, the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, finally denounced the doctrine of discovery. So Abe Lincoln, I feel like in that, was doing something by saying, nope, this is not of God.
Right. Well, and that's, and I certainly am not trying to make Lincoln out to be a white nationalist, but I think what he's saying is, hey guys, listen, if you think that God's on your side, both sides think that, and clearly that can't be the case. And like, and he's not saying like God did say slavery is okay. He's saying like, if you believe that, how do you reconcile that with our current situation where the nation's at war with itself and that you can't, we can't all be right. And I think in some ways laying the groundwork to be like, you're on the wrong side of history and you're probably on the wrong, like you've probably misinterpreted whatever you think God was saying to you about this. And again, Lincoln was someone who clearly like referenced God, but his like actual personal faith orientation was not known. That's not something that, kids are taught in school. And it was very different back then than it is today in a myriad of ways, in terms of how we campaign, in terms of how we govern, and I think in terms of how we conceptualize America's role in the world, like our role in the global community.
We are, in my opinion, disastrously close to losing democracy. And that is a bold statement, but that's where we're at. And let me tell you what was alarming to me, Andy, in that PRRI data was the majority of Christian nationalists. So the vast majority of those who identify as Christian nationalists believe that the nation is so off track that political violence is necessary.
Yeah.
So that statistic jumped out at me in a very big way, because that is where, and that's what we saw on January 6th. We saw political violence as a result of the need to reclaim this country for this invisible threat. And the threat really is progress. That is right. The threat. But the belief is, if like the country is doomed, if we don't save it from this progress, we're going to lose our country, and we have to, and that may take violence in order to do.
Yeah. And I mean, we've already seen violence happen from this, right? In Oklahoma City in particular, right? We know the violence of Christian nationalism very intimately with the Murrah building bombing and Timothy McVeigh, right? Which was, he was pretty open that that was a big part of his belief structure.
Mm-hmm. The federal government was committing atrocities.
Right.
And So it's very interesting to me then that we have become, and I say we as like Oklahoma in general, we have so many leaders right now who have dove into the deep end of the nationalist pool. And I want to bring this back to a civic conversation a little bit, because when only 40% of the population, not just of Oklahoma, but nationwide, when only 40% of people are voting, it's a guaranteed voter block. Mm-hmm. Mobilize this group of people, because they are going to show up to vote because they want their country back.
Right. Because it's, I would guess or assume, right, that in that situation, people are voting not based on, not even like based on like, they're voting with their hearts, right? Like it's about their convictions, their fears in many cases.
Yep.
And I, you know, we see a lot of fear-based rhetoric in campaigning these days. And that, I mean, fundamentally like activates a different response in the human body than like a kumbaya.
Well, and you and I talked about this before we started recording, but Trump's speech last night on Super Tuesday was filled with doomsday, we're in trouble rhetoric. And it's that frame that is really targeting this block of voters who, out of this fear of needing to get our country back, are going to show up at the polls, which is why we see so many politicians now jumping on the bandwagon, because they need those votes to stay in power.
Right. Because if they speak out too heavily, they worry that they're going to lose voters.
Yes, absolutely. And we've seen that happen. We've seen members of the Republican Party suffer vitriol from people who claim to be Christians, but are attacking them because they aren't far enough to the right. They haven't jumped into the Christian nationalist pool. They're trying to stay in a more, you know, open place, adhere to the constitutional values under which this country was founded. Because I also just want to say, the First Amendment was adopted on December 15th of 1791. That is almost 300 years. That's 298 years after the Doctrine of Discovery was written. And they intentionally put that there will be no establishment of a religion in this country, even after 300 years of Doctrine of Discovery.
Right. Right. The, you know, like, I think a contributing factor to this is the information silos in which we live, right? And if you, you know, go to, let's say, an organization on the other side of this conversation, perhaps the Heritage Foundation, right? Which is probably the largest, certainly most influential conservative organization in the country. They have a whole article, it's just called, it's from May of last year, called The Dog Whistle of Christian Nationalism. And it's three key takeaways. I like that they summarize it right up top so you don't have to read it. Takeaway one, the term is mostly used as a smear against conservative Christians who defend the role of religion in American public life. I think we could poke some holes in that of like, well, first of all, you're like, what role of should religion have in American public life, if any? This is the other question. It's not anti-Christian. It's just like, isn't religion personal? Keep it to yourself.
Correct. Personal and intimate.
And then second, just says Jared Yates Sexton likens the resurgence of, quote, Christian nationalism in America to that in Russia under Vladimir Putin and Hungary under Viktor Orban. Who, okay, if you're defending Putin and Orban or something, like, if you brought them into this conversation, well, this is a weird...
You're way red flag.
Take it, right. And then the third one is, its lack of standard definition allows critics to bundle evils like white supremacy and racism with standard conservative views on marriage, family, and politics. Again, words matter. I appreciate that they said that white supremacy and racism are evils. I would agree with that. But saying standard conservative views on marriage, family, and politics, those might be standard. I don't know. They didn't articulate what those views are. But I don't know how, like, I mean, I can think of how Christian nationalism might influence, you know, marriage, politics, and family. But that's not what we're talking about here, right? Like, those things have not come up. We're talking about the enmeshment of this particular religion with a nationalist identity.
Mm-hmm.
And we, I mean, this is like a different conversation, but we see bad things happen when any religion is enmeshed with like that level of patriotism or national identity. There are certainly countries that have deeply held religious beliefs that are tied with a national identity for other religions.
Mm-hmm.
And those countries and that ideology has been a frequent target of this country, right? And in many cases, like, not great. I mean, like, the oppressive politics and lack of civil rights in some like countries in the Middle East, I'm escaping like some of them right now, but Iran, like, some of the stuff we've seen in Iran is like horrific.
Yes.
And those things in some of those countries like have a religious leader as the political head of the country as well, or functional head of the country as well. And what we're saying is like, let's not mix our religion and politics.
Well, because what's going to end up happening is it's going to become the religion of the powerful. And the people in power are going to utilize that as a tool to reduce civil rights. And please don't mistake it. We're already there. We've already seen the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which stripped women of a lot of bodily autonomy rights. We are already seeing attacks on our public school systems, book banning, library attacks. We're seeing that here. We are already losing civil rights because of this viewpoint. So imagine then if it truly becomes enmeshed in our political system, it is literally going to be the religious viewpoint of a few that are in power, who utilize that power and to stay in power forever.
Right.
With that viewpoint.
Right. Because as we said earlier, if this worldview is so enmeshed, questioning any part of it threatens the whole thing.
That's right. And it's not just doxing on the internet for speaking out. It's going to be, you're going to go to jail for speaking out. It gets really dark really quickly. And that is all about the keeping and maintaining of power.
So Shannon, let's kind of bring some of this around to like what we can do. Yeah. Like, how do we take action? Yes. If, you know, if you're a person who's listening to this podcast and you're thinking, okay, well, there seems to be some bright lines in Christian nationalism, right? That like cross the line from like, this is my personal faith and I participate in this church and that's fine. Like, when, how do I identify that rhetoric? How do I see when that is being crossed? And how do I, as an individual, like push back on this? Mm-hmm. Voting is a thing we talk about a lot, but this is more of like a community level change issue. Yeah. With the recognition that people operate in these power structures now, and that can be uncomfortable to challenge power. So I don't know, what any suggestions you have would be much appreciated. Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things that's most helpful for me is the statement that every individual has a right to practice whatever religion they want. However, every individual also has the right to be free from your religion. Mm-hmm. Okay, there is the line. So when we start hearing politicians who are not coming from that place, who maybe are saying, God bless America, okay, like, okay, there's still room for other expressions there, you know, but mm-hmm. if someone's saying, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, or if someone is saying, I claim every county for Jesus Christ, that is putting a religious viewpoint onto people and claiming it in the name of political authority. Mm-hmm. So as we go through our day-to-day lives and we're listening to this rhetoric, which is everywhere now, mm-hmm. try and think of that lens. Even if you identify as a conservative Christian, not every conservative Christian is a Christian nationalist.
Right.
So, yes. So even if you are, you know, one of those that's more of a sympathizer with Christian nationalism, you're not diehard, but you can kind of see where they're coming from and it's mm-hmm. not that harmful. I would encourage everyone to try and take that lens of, okay, but what does that really mean for people who are of a different faith tradition, who maybe aren't sure about their faith tradition, or maybe they don't practice any faith tradition? Is there room in what this person is saying for those people? And if you really are into Christianity and love biblical teachings and love Jesus, that's the viewpoint that makes the most sense, because it's the most loving, affirming of all of your neighbors that you can be.
Right.
And so that's my soapbox. I'm going to plug another option, because make no mistake, the end goal here of the Christian nationalist movement is reversal of civil rights. And one of the biggest protections we have in this country is the separation of church and state, also known as the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. It is because of that that all religious traditions have protection. So Americans United for the Separation of Church and State says it beautifully: religious freedom and the separation is a shield to protect, not a sword to harm. So when we see bills using the term religious freedom, is it protecting everybody or is it weaponizing one view? Because implementing 10 commandments in classrooms and a moment of led prayer by a teacher who is probably, you know, of a certain faith, that's a sword. That's not a shield.
Right.
And so currently, Oklahoma Faith Network has a letter available on our website that every person can go to and sign, and it will send it to your representative and your senator, saying that you support the separation of church and state, and we need to keep religion out of public sectors, most especially our public schools, who are the current target. And the reason the public schools are the target is because they are free and open to every single human being. And there's not other systems like that. That's why the public school system is getting hammered with all of this rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. I saw several people, some elected, some not, last week post some variations of the quote, that you should never trust a politician to tell you what to believe and never trust a faith leader to tell you how to vote.
Yep.
And then I saw some pushback from that, or to that, mostly from members of one party that were like, kind of, I mean, they're basically saying, like, why not? Like, why shouldn't people trust faith leaders to tell them how to vote? And it was, I kept thinking of what you just said, right? Like, it's this assumption that, like, well, they must know best.
Right.
And I think it's appropriate to have a healthy level of skepticism about people's intentions. And you can be skeptical about my intentions and yours and having this podcast. We're not trying to hide anything. Like,
our intent is to tell
you to be critical. I mean, not punitive, but like think critically, right? Examine. Be skeptical, be curious. That's a better phrase. Let's be curious about how things are the way they are and why people say what they say and what are the impacts of this stuff. But I think just on that quote that people posted, I was like, oh, I think there's a lot of folks who are probably like, oh yeah, I don't want politicians to tell me what to believe. Unless that politician is also a faith leader, and then it's okay. And so that's where this happens, right? Like that crossover is like, I've got all my answers in one place. I don't have to think for myself. This guy is going to tell me how to think, what to believe, how to vote, and I'll just trust him.
Which is incredibly attractive when you're scared. So when people are creating a world when you are fearful, then the person with the most certainty is the most cozy because they're going to tell you what to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. That's tough too, because like life is busy and most people don't have time to like do their research and find out stuff. But you want to look for trusted messengers.
Yes.
And it's, I would hope, right, if you are an adherent to a faith that you feel like your faith leader is someone that you trust and could look to. But if, I don't know, if that's you, listeners, if you attend a church and your faith leader or someone you look up to has messages that you kind of wonder about, or they kind of make you feel a little uncomfortable or something, but you're not sure. And you just want to like figure stuff out. One, you can talk to them about it. Nothing wrong with that. Like you should at least feel like you should follow up with them and be like, hey, can I ask you about this? I think if anyone listening has any questions about Christian nationalism, how to identify this stuff, what to do about it, how to push back, how to move forward with care and concern for others while being appropriately, you know, curious about things, please feel free to send an email to podcast@letsfixthis.org. I'll share it with Shannon and maybe we can respond in a future episode, or if necessary, reach out to the author independently. But I think something else we could do related to this, right, is like find ways to talk to others in our life, including our children, about this, right?
Yes. Absolutely. I have a 9-year-old daughter. She's almost 10 and she is incredibly curious. And she comes home with some pretty wild statements. I know she's not getting them from her teachers. So I know that students talk.
Yeah.
And Which is a perfect opportunity to have dialogue with your children, to have dialogue with, you know, your parents and grandparents around, you'll never believe what Marilyn came home and said today. And then have an opportunity to dialogue about why that feels alarming to you. And at the very least, you're letting the people in your circle know, this is potentially crossing a line. What do you think? Bare minimum.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's also important again to realize that this viewpoint is still in the minority. When we're looking at the data, this Christian nationalist stuff is still not the majority of Americans.
Right.
So also important to keep that in mind.
Yes. No, that's a very good point. Though, to bring this back to civics, right?
Yeah.
The voter turnout among this group is pretty high, right? They are very impassioned people. They're very convicted people, believe it. And so they vote at a very high rate.
Yep.
And so when it feels like a vocal minority is driving the narrative, it's probably because more of them are speaking, right?
Like, yep.
And so listeners, for you, that's something else you can do, right? This is about whether it's talking to your friends, your kids, writing op-eds to your local newspaper, whatever it is, like this is conversations that you can have. They might be nuanced. They, you know, you're not trying to win over everyone in the first conversation, but sometimes opportunities will present themselves for you to have a conversation, and let's find ways to have that. I have some, we'll kind of wrap up here, but I have some friends who are, they have three kids that are like middle school into high school now. And the parents are pretty liberal, right? Like pretty outspoken liberal. Not like aggressive, but just like, you know, it seems weird to be like, say that's like a flaming liberal thing to have like a Black Lives Matter sign in your yard or that kind of stuff. But they're environmentalist and pretty outspoken liberals. And their kids know it. And but their oldest child is in high school now and has started kind of pushing back on some of the liberalism. And it's like really freaking out the parents, right? Of like, oh my gosh. And it's like, okay, well, first of all, like, every kid wants to be different than their parents, and like some differentiation is very normal. And it is also, I think, forcing the parents to more closely examine their own liberal beliefs about stuff and be like, okay, why do I believe this? And like, is it defensible? And can I articulate why this is our values? Which I think is really healthy. And we've had this conversation of like, it's hard. You want your kids just to like, everyone wants their kids to like fall in line, do the right thing, but we also want them to be independent thinkers, and we just want them to be independent like us or something. And so it is, I think, a healthy and helpful exercise for all of us to like examine why we believe what we believe. And that's an ongoing thing that you don't figure it out when you're 21. You don't figure it out when you're 42. I'm sure in 20 years, I'm in my 60s, I'll be questioning stuff once again, right?
Let's hope that our minds never settle into the cracks, and we make it a habit to be lifelong learners.
Right. Yeah. We change in all kinds of ways, right? Mm-hmm. I was eating some pasta this week my wife made with artichokes in it, and I was like, man, this is delicious. And I just laughed to myself of like, 20-year-old Andy would have abhorred that I was eating, much less enjoying, like artichoke hearts and pasta. And like, as a silly example of like, listen, we all grow and evolve, and society should as well, right? And we hope that we're moving towards a more perfect union and not away from it.
Right. Exactly. A perfect union for everybody.
Exactly right. Well, Shannon, this has been delightful as always. Thank you so much for being on again.
Yeah, we'll do it again, I'm sure.
Listeners, thank you for being here. Again, if you have questions or thoughts, whatever, and you want to share, please send an email to podcast@letsfixthis.org. We'd love to hear from you. We always love hearing from you, and I try to respond to each and every email I receive. In this case, I'll definitely loop in Reverend Fleck as well. As a reminder, decisions are made by those who show up. I know we just had Super Tuesday. That means our next elections are in, I think there's some in April, as well as filing deadlines. And then June, August, November, it's a big year. And we're going to be having a lot more opportunities for you to get involved in the coming months, because now that we're kind of through some of this stuff, it's go time. The legislative session is still happening. And as we move into like the general election season, forget about the presidency. That's a thing. That's a race that will happen. But there are tons of other races on the ballot that are much closer to home, that have a much more direct impact on your life and mine, and that you can have a much more direct impact in as well. So decisions are made by those who show up. Please, please, please find ways to show up. All right. On that note, have a great weekend.